Today is Monday, August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban says it's overrun three major cities in Afghanistan.
The government does not confirm any of the three, although in one in Kunduz city, the government says it has launched a counter-operation.
Plus, the U.S. intelligence community is expected to deliver its report on the origins of COVID-19 this month. And the 2020 Olympic Games come to a close. We'll have these stories and more next. The Taliban continued their military offenses over the weekend, reportedly overrunning at least three provincial capitals by Sunday evening. This is after they captured Zaraj on Friday and detonated bombs in the country's capital. VOA's Aisha Tanzim is in Kabul and joins us with an update on the fighting.
We know that there are three cities in the north and northeastern Afghanistan that the Taliban forces claim that they overran. The government does not confirm any of the three, although in one in Kunduz city, the government says it has launched a counter-operation. And even in Saraipul, in the Saraipul province, it's not confirming that it was overrun, but eyewitnesses and local sources told us so. Kunduz is a very significant city. The Taliban have tried to overrun it three times since 2010. The last two times they were able to get to the center of the city, but were only able to stay there for a couple of days each before government forces attacked and took it back from the Taliban. So just because it was overrun doesn't mean the Taliban can hold it. We will see in the coming days what happens. Takeover of the provincial capital, it started Friday with the first provincial capital in Nimroz province, Zaraj, falling to the Taliban. Saturday, a second provincial capital, Shabargan, fell to the Taliban in Jawzjan. That is also home to former warlord and Afghanistan's highest-ranking military officer, Marshal Abdurrashid Dostum. Previously, Taliban were taking over only rural territory, but now they have actually started going after provincial capitals.
Aisha, I wanted to ask you about something that President Ashraf Ghani mentioned last week, and that was that he had a plan, he said, that would turn things around in about 6 months. Do we know anything more about the president's plan to take on the Taliban?
No, it continues to stay vague. He has said that the plan will work in about 6 months. He has said that the plan has already been launched. And like I said, very few details, just that the military will defend strategic targets. The Interior Ministry will be responsible, which the Interior Ministry oversees the police. That will look after the district centers. And the NDS will coordinate with the people's militias, what is being called as public uprisings against the Taliban. And President Ghani has also asked on all parliamentarians to help the defense forces by asking all the people that they influence, all the people who voted for them, to rise up against the Taliban in the form of public uprising.
Aisha, the fighting is not only taking place in rural areas as well as the provincial capitals now, but also there have been a pair of bombings recently in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. And I was wondering if you could speak to the strategy of why the Taliban is taking the fight there.
Well, there are two things that are happening there. The Afghan forces have the biggest advantage they have is the air force. Wherever the Afghans are using the air force, the Taliban are forced back. So the Taliban are trying to level the playing field by going after the pilots, because the air force is no use without trained pilots, and they have already killed somewhere between 6 to 8 of them. So the Taliban are trying to level the playing field, and they're trying to make the Afghan edge, take away the Afghan edge with the air force. And the attack on the defense minister's house, well, first of all, it really, the Taliban know what an attack inside Kabul, especially so close to the green zone, means. It shows the government's weaknesses. It really makes the public jittery and panicky when Taliban can attack inside Kabul. And that's exactly what the Taliban want. They want to show that they can attack anywhere they want. And of course, the Afghan government's response is that, defending the entire country, I mean, attacking in suicide attacks or guerrilla ambushes is easy because, of course, you have a surprise on your side. Defending is more difficult because, as they say, the cliche goes, you know, they have to succeed 100% of the times, whereas the attackers only have to succeed one time.
Reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan, is VOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief, Aisha Tanzim. The U.S. intelligence community is expected to send a report to President Joe Biden later this month, examining the two leading theories on the origins of COVID-19. One claims that the virus was accidentally released from a lab. The other emerged from human contact with an infected animal. VOA's Jisasumi Oni has that story.
Nearly 18 months into the COVID-19 global pandemic, questions remain over the origins of the virus. The U.S. intelligence community has said it does not know exactly where, when, or how the virus was first transmitted. And just this past June, the top U.S. intelligence official warned intelligence agencies may never find a so-called smoking gun. But the issue has become a potent political topic in Congress. Most Democrats are waiting on the intelligence findings, but Republicans this month released a report advocating another theory on COVID's origins, one already rejected by U.S. intelligence officials, claiming there is paper trail that shows China's Wuhan Institute of Virology was involved with dangerous research, manipulating the virus's genetic code.
We said it was a possibility. Now I believe there's a preponderance of evidence that it did. It was manufactured in the lab and it leaked, most likely accidentally.
Republican Representative Michael McCaul told VOA's Mandarin service the Chinese government is withholding important data on possible early infections in September 2019.
Well, I think the WHO was very ineffective in warning the world about a global pandemic. They've been very ineffective in investigating this. At the end of the day, the answer from top scientists are sitting in the archives of the Wuhan lab itself that the PRC will not release publicly.
Yet while there is frustration with the way China has answered questions about the outbreak, the leading theory among many scientists is that the virus did in fact originate from a natural source. Virologist Dr. Ben Newman, who has studied coronaviruses for 25 years.
It looks a lot like all the other bat viruses that are out there, and there aren't any specific features you could find on this virus that you can't find on several more coronaviruses.
President Joe Biden in May gave the U.S. intelligence community 90 days to provide an in-depth assessment of the coronavirus origins.
The president asked the intelligence community to redouble their efforts to collect and analyze information that could bring us closer to a definitive conclusion.
Beijing has resisted prior international efforts to investigate the virus's origins and in July rejected a bid by the World Health Organization to conduct a second phase of investigations in Wuhan. China also dismissed the lab leak theory as defying science.
In order to shift its responsibility in poor COVID-19 response and out of the political motive of smearing and suppressing others, U.S. has been busy with the politicization, stigmatization, and turning always tracing study into its tool.
Experts say it's critical to find the origin of a virus that has so far killed more than 4 million people worldwide.
It's like finding a leak in the dam and then, you know, you can plug it and then you no longer have the leak, basically. And we do not know where that is or how imminent the danger is, whether this thing is really close or far away, whether there are lots of different variants of this thing or whether it was a one-time thing.
The U.S. intelligence community has said there is no available evidence that the virus was man-made or genetically modified. Jason Samelny, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The Russian government's COVID-19 vaccine diplomacy with its Sputnik V vaccine has run into some problems. Daria Degus takes it from here.
Soon after signing an agreement with the Russian government to receive the Sputnik V vaccine, the country of Guatemala received 550,000 doses. It ordered 8 million. So the Guatemalan government canceled the vaccine orders from Russia to buy doses made by Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson. Brazil stopped buying the Sputnik V, saying its health regulator Anvisa rejected the vaccine. Officials in Argentina say the country never received millions of Sputnik doses. And on top of delivery issues, Richard Reitinger from the Research Triangle Institute says the fact that the two doses of the vaccine are very different further complicates the vaccination process.
What the Sputnik V vaccine is that it uses two different adenoviruses for the first shot and then the booster shot 21 days later. And essentially, that means you have to produce two separate vaccines. You will have to have two different production processes, two different teams of people that produce it, and of course, very stringent quality control steps to make sure that the two are separated.
Part of the problem, experts say, is Russia's refusal to operate within the international systems that have been set up to fight COVID.
Russia has not been transparent with how it's negotiating delivery of these vaccines. So it's not operating through COVAX, the World Health Organization is doing it bilaterally, country by country, and we have no idea, you know, what the arrangements or contracts or payments are for the system. And now Russia is not even able to deliver what it said it was going to deliver. So, you know, I think it's been a fiasco from start to finish. You know, let me say, Russian science is extraordinarily good. I want to see this vaccine succeed. But the government and the governance of this vaccine has been lacking.
A new wave of COVID-19 in Russia has also affected the deliveries. To help solve the problem, Russia has signed a contract with the Serum Institute of India, one of the world's largest vaccine producers. But officials at the institute cannot begin producing Sputnik V until September at the earliest.
You know, it's a disaster for these countries. You know, you have to put yourself in the position of a low-income country where your people are dying, the coronavirus, and particularly with the Delta variant, it's spreading like wildfire. Their economies are going bust. Their hospitals are overfull and stretched beyond capacity. And so they're clutching for any lifeline. The Russian Sputnik vaccine was supposed to be the lifeline. Now they can't even get that.
A Kremlin spokesperson insists that all the foreign contracts will be fulfilled, but they have yet to release exact dates for vaccine delivery. But in many cases, the fight against COVID is a race against time, and time to wait for a vaccine is something many countries don't have. Daria Degus for VOA News, Washington.
Australia is to compensate some survivors of a former assimilation policy that separated Indigenous children from their families. Phil Mercer has those details.
Members of the so-called Stolen Generations in the Australian Capital Territory, the region surrounding the capital Canberra, and the Northern Territory will receive a one-off payment of $60,000. It's part of an $800 million program to address the disadvantages faced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as a result of the continued trauma of historic family separations. Most Australian states have their own reparation schemes, but authorities in Queensland and Western Australia are being urged to do more to compensate survivors of the Stolen Generations. Tens of thousands of Indigenous Australian children were removed over several decades until the early 1970s. It was a deliberate policy to assimilate often mixed-race children into white society. Eileen Cummins was taken as a child from her family in Australia's Northern Territory. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that her memories are still vivid.
Without no indication that they were going to remove me. They never told my mother. My mother was watching them take me away in the truck, but she couldn't say anything. Here I am, this 4.5-year-old kid on the back of a truck with a patrol officer. And where did they take me? To the Maranboy police station. When they took me away, I just kept crying because I wanted my mother and my people.
In February 2008, the Australian government formally apologised for forcibly taking Indigenous children from their families. Australia's original inhabitants make up just over 3% of the population and suffer high levels of disadvantage. The government in Canberra last year said it would reset its efforts to improve Indigenous life expectancy, which is about 10 years less than the general population, as well as inequalities in education. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
Yes, it was one of those nights when you couldn't fall asleep. So since you didn't get any sleep at all, you think, I'll get through the day by just drinking beverages with a lot of caffeine in them. Michigan State University scientists wanted to know how good caffeine was in helping sleepless people function throughout the day. The researchers' findings were published in a new study, and it suggests that while caffeine can help you get through some simple tasks, the stimulant doesn't work as well when faced with your more complex duties. Lead researcher Kimberly Fenn says that while people may feel as though they can fight the effects of sleep deprivation with caffeine, their performance on higher level tasks will likely still be impaired. In other words, like the old saying, caffeine is no substitute for a good night's sleep. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In the longest-running protest of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government, farmers have been camped around the Indian capital for over 8 months to demand the scrapping of new laws that they fear will ruin their livelihoods. Anjana Pasricha visits the protest site to see how and why farmers have braved winter, summer, the pandemic's ferocious second wave, and the monsoon rains.
As monsoon rains lash New Delhi, another temporary structure comes up along this highway, which is now a gigantic protest site for growers from North India. In winter, they huddled in farm tractor trailers. As the scorching summer arrived, they put up structures with fans and coolers. Now the monsoons pose a new challenge. The farmers shrug aside the harsh conditions of life on the road.
In December, when it is bitterly cold, we leave our homes to water fields at night when we are given electricity. In summer, we work under the sun. We sow our land during the monsoons. In any case, a protest can only succeed if you are willing to bear hardships.
These farmers fear that three new laws allowing the sale of farm produce to private companies without the previously guaranteed minimum price will end decades-long government support for some crops and ultimately force them to sell the small plots of land most own. Being a landowner is their only identity.
I am attached to my land in the same way that my nail is joined to my flesh. It is both my mother and father. It is everything to me. If my land does not stay, there's no point in my living any longer.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has assured them that the laws will help them gain access to new markets and raise incomes, but they are not convinced.
The government says that we do not understand the law. Why don't they explain the benefits to us?
Limited numbers have been allowed to come from heavily barricaded highways to protest outside Parliament. opposition parties have rallied with them. They're warning, until the laws are rolled back, they will not budge from Delhi. Many stayed on even as the pandemic's second wave tore through Delhi this summer. They say the laws pose a bigger threat to them than the virus.
The government has not budged an inch, but if they are rigid, then farmers can also be very stubborn. We also will never step back. If we return without achieving our target, in any case, our entire life's work stands defeated.
Like the seasons, the mood at the protest site swings, at times charged, at times languid. Many shuttle between the highway and their villages, but they remain preoccupied with their struggle.
Our eyes are always on television and on our mobiles for the news from Delhi, hoping for some relief, hoping that our voice has been heard.
So far, however, there is no sign of an end to the longest-running protest against Modi as negotiations remain stalled. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The Tokyo 2020 Olympics have come to a close, with the U.S. topping the medal standing once again. Associated Press correspondent John Leatherby has more.
Kara Winger of Seattle, a four-time Olympian in javelin, led American athletes into the Olympic Stadium to close out the 17-day event in a ceremony rich in Japanese tradition, but due to the pandemic, attendance confined to athletes, coaches, and officials. In all, the U.S. finished first in both total gold medals and overall medal count. 39 first-place showings and 113 total medallions. IOC President Thomas Bach called on the world to meet again in Paris in 2024 as the Olympic flame was extinguished. I'm John Leatherby.
In Sunday's competition, Kenyan marathoner Eliud Kipchoge became the first repeat winner of the event in 40 years with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 38 seconds, more than a minute ahead of the rest of the field. Now, with the Games in Tokyo over and the Olympic flame extinguished, it won't be long before once more athletes from around the world come together to compete, although this time for the Winter Games. As Bill Gallo reports, it's not unusual for the Olympic Games to attract controversy. Then again, not every Olympics is hosted by a country that's being accused of genocide. That's what's creating waves as the 2022 Winter Olympics approach.
In just 6 months, China will host the Winter Olympics. But for many human rights advocates, that's nothing to celebrate. In fact, the Beijing Games may be among the most controversial in recent history. China has locked up over 1 million Uyghur Muslims in places in western China. Many were jailed for having a beard or reading the Quran. It's genocide, according to many rights groups. But International Olympic Committee Chief Thomas Bach says such issues don't concern the organization. The Olympics, he says, cannot be political.
As a non-governmental organization with neither the mandate nor the capability to change laws of sovereign countries, we cannot solve human rights issues which generations of politicians were unable to solve.
But that rationale seems offensive to many Uyghurs. Rashan Abbas is a Uyghur whose sister, a retired medical doctor, was jailed on terrorism charges.
So let me ask this, is genocide a political issue? Is mass rape of the innocent women, is that a political problem? Living in an Orwellian hell of surveillance, innocent people put in concentration camps, is that a political thing?
Since her sister's disappearance, Abbas has turned to activism. One of her main focuses is the Olympics. She's calling for a boycott, even though that would deprive many athletes of their chance to compete.
When we talk about athletes missing out, it's missing the point entirely that Uyghurs are missing their entire families, the Uyghurs are dying, and that they have had their property, dignity, loved ones, and their very lives are stripped away.
Many rights groups are calling for diplomats and other officials to boycott the event. Yachiel Wang is a researcher with Human Rights Watch.
Because by attending the event, it's a, they can be used as a tool by the Chinese government to legitimize, their crimes against humanities and other numerous human rights violations.
It's not clear how big the boycott will be. Even some in the U.S. are reluctant to participate. Meanwhile, the IOC says it must remain neutral.
They have not publicly criticized Beijing for any of its human rights violations, not to mention talking about, you know, moving the Olympic to any other place. The IOC is far, far from doing anything meaningful.
So in 6 months, the Beijing Games will begin with a massive cloud of controversy hanging over them. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
And finally, China's wolf warrior diplomacy represents China as an aggressive rising superpower. The name is inspired by the Chinese blockbuster Wolf Warrior film franchise, which first debuted in 2015. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with experts on film and Chinese diplomacy about the franchise, its Hollywood influence, and its phenomenal appeal with Chinese audiences.
Wolf Warrior is a high-budget action film franchise about a Chinese soldier turned contractor fighting against American-led terrorist groups to protect China's interests.
The Wolf Warrior movie franchise and Wolf Warrior diplomacy are symptoms of the same attitude. They are symptoms together of the rise of China, of a new generation of Chinese who want to make more of an impact on the world, who are less inclined to compromise.
Wolf Warrior 2 was released in 2017 and took China by storm, earning nearly $900 million at the box office, with more than 99% of its revenue generated in the Chinese domestic market. Michael Berry, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, says these films are based on Chinese melody films, state-sponsored films invoking nationalist pride.
They're often released to correspond with various national holidays, like National Day, and they resonate with various patriotic themes.
One of them is The Founding of a Republic, which was produced in 2009 to mark the 60th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. The Wolf Warrior film franchise is also modeled after 1980s American patriotic action film franchises, such as Rambo and Rocky, where the hero, played by Sylvester Stallone, fights against foreign villains in the name of American democracy and justice. In Wolf Warrior 2, the Chinese hero defends stranded Chinese civilians and defenseless Africans in an unnamed African country.
It's also got a colonialist attitude to non-white peoples. And we're just seeing the white savior of American action films being replaced by the Chinese savior in Chinese films.
The Wolf Warrior films boast cutting-edge special effects and feature Hollywood actors such as Frank Grillo, who plays Big Daddy, the American villain, in Wolf Warrior 2.
He played Crossbones in the Captain America films, and so he's a direct bridge between those two worlds. But it wasn't just Frank Grillo. Also, the action choreographer, I believe his name is Sam Hargrave, he was also the action choreographer for Captain America Civil War and a lot of these big Marvel films.
Despite this artistic and technological cross-pollination, the two film industries compete against each other, not only in terms of their message, but also in terms of box office revenue. Wolf Warrior 2 surpassed Avengers Endgame at the Chinese box office.
It was able to do the same kind of business that an Avengers movie does in one market, and that's the China market, especially with the anti-American sentiment that's been rising since, since the period that Donald Trump was president. A lot of Chinese audiences have also cooled off about Hollywood.
Berry says China's effective handling of COVID-19 has allowed for the Chinese film industry to recuperate faster than Hollywood. He says it has also contributed to the surge of Chinese patriotism.
I think what we're seeing with this Wolf Warrior diplomacy are various diplomats and public figures from the Chinese public sphere or political sphere standing up and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. Enough of the humiliation. China is not your lapdog. We are not going to stand for it.
Berry adds that China's funding of Chinese blockbusters could sideline Hollywood experts in the Chinese market. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.